Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 Bacon Bundle. Because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the Bacon Cheese Slider, 1921 Bacon Cheese Slider, or Chicken Bacon Ranch Slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 Bacon Bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
Welcome, everyone, to Monday Match Analysis. I'm Gil Gross. Carlos Alcaraz and Jannik Sinner have cruised into the fourth round at Indian Wells. I'm going to go long on Alcaraz over Felix Auger-Aliassime, about medium length on Sinner over Jan-Lennard Struff, and I'll go short on Rublev being upset by Jiří Lehečka. Finish it off with a Coco Gauff stat that made people go crazy. There's also a Federer, Nadal, Djokovic, Murray tie into this stat. I want to talk about it. It's kind of interesting. If you follow me on Twitter, you'll know where I'm going. This is always a little bit tricky in terms of what matches do I cover on the first Monday of a Masters 1000 in this new 12-day format. Obviously, it's a little bit unclear. Last year, for the most part, I wouldn't do a Monday match analysis. I would just do coverage, day by day, as needed coverage of the tournament, maybe a post-match. But I didn't want to do that this week. Here's why. I am not going to be around this week. So this will be the last you hear from me until the Monday match analysis breaking down the Indian Wells final. The reason is an exciting one. I am calling the Phoenix Challenger this week. So I will be going over to Phoenix tomorrow morning. It is a 175-point challenger that was kind of a new thing that the ATP introduced last year in terms of that level. They're especially effective during the second week of Masters 1000 tournaments. Those who lost early at Indian Wells have a decision to make. Either they can twiddle their thumbs until Miami and not play a match for over a week, or they can go to Phoenix, which has pretty decent rankings points, pretty decent prize money, and play the challenger over there. As a result, there has also been an investment to make the product better. The high-level challengers to make the product better on the broadcast side of things, and I am very, very proud to be a part of that effort, and I am excited to do my very best and get eyes and do this Phoenix Challenger justice. The field is amazing. Matteo Berrettini is coming back from injury. Mackie McDonald is coming back from injury. Andy Murray, he might play. I think he's supposed to play. As far as I know, he's playing. And that'll be cool for me to call an Andy Murray match, which I have done, but never in person. Chris Eubanks, Jack Draper, Giron, Nuno Borges is the defending champion. So I'm excited to call these matches, be on site, hopefully have some great conversations with players and coaches. And if you go to the Phoenix Challenger, come say hi, except not when I'm on air. Wait until the match is over, then come say hi. If you're interested in tuning in, it will be available on ATP Challenger TV. That can be found on the ATP website. It will also be on Tennis Channel Plus, and it will be on T2 Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, as well as on television in Italy. I don't know exactly what channel, but it will be on in Italy. Carlos Alcaraz defeats Felix Auger-Aliassime 6-2, 6-3 in an hour and 17 minutes. Not very competitive. Came down to this. Alcaraz's return was dominant against Felix's serve, and we've had conversations about what went wrong for Felix last year. Was it that his weaknesses were exposed? And my response has been, well, I don't know that that's it. I think it's more the strengths aren't working. Because when he was winning in 2022 and he had the season where, what, he won like 60 matches, it wasn't that he was a beast in neutral rallies, that he was defending incredibly well. It was literally on these in these indoor tournaments that he was dominating. And even on some occasions outdoors in high-profile matches, like against Nadal on clay at Roland Garros, players were having a ton of trouble just handling Felix's serve plus one. It just, they weren't able to neutralize it. And this was another match where the Felix serve plus one, it was handled. It was handled very, very decisively. Felix hit one ace in the match. He won barely over 50% of his first serve points. Again, it's pretty simple against Felix. Are you neutralizing his serve plus one? Because if he's not winning on his first two swings when he's serving, if he's not winning on his first two swings of the racket, or at least coming away with a significant advantage after two swings of the racket, serve plus one, he's going to have major problems. Five plus shot rallies in this match were 25-9 for Alcaraz. 25-9. Now, in that respect, it's going to be hard to win a match like that. And that actually comes down to some of his weaknesses, which I'll get into, which are a factor. So it's not completely one or the other. But what I found was in the service games where Felix was broken, the common thread was he had no serve plus one success. He ended up in those extended rallies that he wasn't having any chance of winning. If you zoom in on the first break of serve in the first set and the first break of serve in the second set for Alcaraz, if you just look at those games, now in both cases, Carlitos would end up going up a double break. But if you just look at the first one, there were 0 points in total. In those two games, 0 points where Felix hit either an unreturned serve or a plus one finish, meaning a winner, a forced error, Alcaraz, not even Alcaraz making a return unforced error, nothing. Felix never won any points in those two service games on two shots. And if you look at, and this is even just as important, the stats won't flesh this out, but when I'm watching the match, I can see this. If you look at, well, did Felix have an advantage after his serve plus one? Only once. There was 1 point where he hit a serve and an approach shot, and he was in good position, but his volley was bad. So on his third shot, he hit a bad volley and he lost the point. That was it. So you're not going to have a match between Alcaraz and Felix, a close match between Alcaraz and Felix. And I get it's Indian Wells. It's not the fastest conditions. It's not going to be a close match if Felix's first serve and his first forehand isn't doing a ton of talking. Just wasn't in this match. And you could see that in the ace count, in the first serve points won. Also, I did have a look at, you know, the spot serving. Felix made 67% of his first serves. So that's high for him. That's well above average. But I'm looking at his spread. And if you're watching on YouTube, you're looking at his spread. I see a lot of missed spots there. I don't think that's very precise serving. Look on the ad side. Every time he hit a decent spot out wide on the ad side, he won the point. Every time. But that just wasn't often enough. Only three serves. And then on the deuce side, that's where he had real problems. It looks like he missed his spot on a lot of tee serves that ended up costing him. And same thing going out wide on the deuce side. The two times he really tucked it inside the sideline, he won both those points, but he only did it twice. And you see a lot of red dots that are more, you know, further away from the sideline. So I just don't think he was very precise with that first serve. And the forehand was fine. I blame the serve more than the forehand. And by the way, Alcaraz returned great. He was right on it. So I don't want to make this just about Felix's serve. Alcaraz was really striking the return very, very well. And when I talk about neutralizing FAA's serve plus one, what is usually true about the return? Well, for Alcaraz, there was an impressive frequency at which Felix had to hit a first ball backhand. And then when he didn't have a first ball backhand, it was deep enough through the middle that Felix just couldn't really get a good cut on it and didn't have a chance to really move forward, step in, take a lot of time away, which he does do very well on the next shot after his serve. He didn't really have a chance to do that. So quality of return really high from Alcaraz, and he made a bunch. So four great sets in a row for Carlos Alcaraz in this tournament. He beats Matteo Arnaldi after losing the first set, and it was a error-filled first set. He wins the next two sets 6-1, 6-love, and now 6-2, 6-3 against FAA. Multiple breaks of serve in every single set. Movement has been great. Ball striking has been really clean, particularly on the forehand. The heaviness is crazy, and the consistency has been there. And I think that that is the most important thing when it comes to having success on this surface. The court gives you time, and the court asks you to generate. So you're going to have a chance to take big cuts on your forehand. And Alcaraz, he's really taking advantage of that. And honestly, I don't think I've ever seen anybody generate ball speed better than Alcaraz. So the two things I've discussed so far, the return and the pace generation off of Alcaraz's forehand, both of those things showed up in this point that I want to highlight. So here's a first serve from Felix that was a missed spot, and Alcaraz hits the backhand return inside in very nicely to Felix's backhand. This is a first serve return that puts FAA on the defense. I mean, that's impressive. At this point, I drew an arrow to the left because you can see now that Felix moving to his left, this is going to be a backhand slice cross court. You can almost guarantee that this is going to be a backhand slice cross court. So Alcaraz can already start shuffling to his left, and FAA hits the floating backhand slice cross court, retreats to the Indian Wells logo. And now it's, you know, Alcaraz is in a great position here. No doubt about it. He's going to load up the forehand. But again, FAA, middle of the court, shaded towards inside out. Alcaraz has no pace to work with, and he blows it right by FAA. This forehand was 103 miles per hour. And I have no doubt that many, many players on the tour would have ultimately won this point against Felix from the position that Alcaraz was in with his forehand there. I have a lot of doubt about how many players would have hit a winner off of this ball, especially going inside out, given where Felix was on the court and given how little pace Alcaraz had to work with. He hit the ball 103 miles per hour with zero pace to work with. I'm telling you, I have seen a lot of big forehands, a lot of triple digit forehands. They're not that uncommon. They're just not. 100 mile per hour forehands are not that rare. I have never seen somebody do it with regularity off of extremely slow balls the way I've seen it with Alcaraz. It's a very, very, very special level of pace generation. So I really think that's key on this court surface. Another thing that's great in these conditions for Alcaraz is the get out of jail tactic, which is the kick serve out wide on the ad side, usually followed by a forehand inside in. He faced one break point in this match against Felix, and what did he do? He hit a kick serve out wide, which is probably his most reliable serve that he just makes over and over again. He usually finds a good angle on it, and this court is bouncy. So Felix is off, you know, pulled off the court, past the single sideline, hitting a backhand above shoulder level. It's a horrible position to be in. He's going to try to take the backhand return cross court, but Alcaraz knows that. And again, you start to bring into play the foot speed, the, you know, how quickly Alcaraz is able to get around his backhand. And now he has the open court to hit the forehand inside in against. I mean, I think the best thing to do against this kind of serve is maybe to stand back a little bit. It's hard to take it early enough. It'll be interesting if he plays Demonora. Demonora will probably try to take that serve super early on the rise, and we'll see if it works. But wow, the kick wide on this court, and it's the same thing in Madrid, another tournament Alcaraz won last year. It feels like such a great play for Alcaraz to go to. Thing is, you got to do your scouting, and you got to know first break point of the match, he's probably going to do this. So you got to be ready for the kick serve. And if there's no element of surprise, it really increases your chances of coming up with a better return. So that's kind of the get out of jail tactic. And that's all of the good things I have to say about Alcaraz. I do have one nitpick, and then I'm going to go back to Felix. My one nitpick is the second serve return strategy for Carlitos versus Arnaldi. He lost the first set. He backed up on second serve returns. It helped him immensely for the rest of the match, and he blew the brakes off of Mateo. I was curious to see what was his plan A going to be against Felix. Not what was his adjustment going to be. Where was he going to start? And again, he started in, and again, he moved back eventually. Somewhere in the middle to the start of the second set, he started moving back. For the life of me, I do not understand why standing in was plan A. You are the better baseliner, Alcaraz. I'm going to say all of this from Alcaraz's perspective. You are the better baseliner. He always serves body. Almost always, his second serves go into the body with a lot of speed. So if he's going to hit a body serve, a fast one, on his second, and you're better from the baseline, why would you stand in? I don't understand that at all. You know, the games where Felix held in this match were the games where Alcaraz just missed returns. I mean, for the most part, that is really the common thread every time FAA held. And in many of those games, it wasn't just first serves. It was a couple of second serves here and there. So I just felt that was the wrong tactic given the opponent. I understand the merit in Alcaraz trying to take time away and being aggressive from time to time. But to me, nothing about this opponent suggested that he should have been standing in. Okay, Felix. First thing I want to check in on is the serve stats, because one of the things I highlighted was last year compared to the year before, first serve percentage dropped 4%, ace rate dropped 3%. And just to give you an idea, it might sound like not a lot, but on first serve percentage, the 4% drop made him go from 34th on tour to 59th on tour. So that's how many, that's a pretty big difference. And I just want to say this year, so far, he's basically in between. Not as bad as last year, not as good as 2022. And that makes sense. That's exactly what I would guess. As I mentioned, I don't think his serve was deadly enough in these conditions to give him a chance to win this match. But he also started three or four games with double faults. He had a total of five double faults, but I think four were to start the game. It's not, you know, it's better than break point, but it's not as good as you're up 30 love or you're up 40 love or 40-15, right? So it's not a great thing. He struggled with that outdoors, still doesn't hit the kick serve. That's something that comes up. But the backhand was the big killer. The backhand was the reason why, the biggest reason why that Alcaraz developed this massive advantage in the long points. Felix just misses so often when he's looking to hit a simple backhand trade cross court. So when I say so often, I at the very least mean too often. There are too many times every match where the ball is not deep, it is not fast, Felix is not moving, Felix is not trying to be offensive. It's just your regulation rally ball backhand, the kind of backhand that you would hit when you're training cross courts, and he misses this backhand a lot. Of course, the backhand also provides a safe space to hit second serves into, which Alcaraz did time and time again. And Felix wasn't really able to attack the second serve return, and he would normally miss it, especially on the ad side when he went down the line off of it. And then, as Alcaraz also showed, if you're skilled enough to hit, if you're skilled enough to get the return into Felix's backhand, it's also a safe space. Lastly, volley execution was a bit of an issue. There were some serve plus ones that looked good. He would hit it as an approach shot, and then he just wasn't clinical enough on the volley. And when you're playing someone with the speed of Alcaraz, a lot of the times it's going to require that volley to finish the deal. And FAA struggled in that department. So that's kind of the state of Felix. You know, I wish I had more praise, but I don't know in this particular match anything he did exceptionally well. All I would say was the forehand to me wasn't the problem, wasn't the culprit. Like, I would point to everything else: serve, backhand, volleys, you know, all of that stuff. I don't think the forehand was the problem. That's what I'll say. Alcaraz has Marojan next. That's interesting, right? First time they've played since Monte Carlo. Then maybe Demonor, then maybe Sinner in the semifinal. And what I can say about Alcaraz, look, Sinner is playing awesome as well, which I'm about to talk about, but am I sweating about picking him to lose in the quarters? Yeah, I'm sweating. He looks amazing, and I have long thought that if he just plays the same tennis that he did last year at Indian Wells, he should win this title. That was unbelievable tennis. So I think, you know, it just comes down to mental in these tougher matchups. And that's what it's going to come down to, because clearly the timing and the comfort in the ball striking and the control, all of that is there. But can he play high percentage? Can he make high percentage decisions against a guy in Demonor who is going to give him a high volume of balls in the court? And will he have a good level on high pressure points in a tough battle against a great player? Like, those are the questions right now, because the level is there in general. And the Sinner one, psychologically, again, I feel bad talking about this. He also has to still beat Fabian Marojan. But again, I'm not going to be around for the rest of the week, so I just want to say these things. Psychologically, if we do get the Alcaraz Sinner semifinal, it's a reversal. A little bit. Not to say that there's no pressure on Alcaraz there. Like, I think there is still overall pressure for him to have a big week, to break out of the slump, to win another title, to get a win over Sinner. Like, I think that pressure is there. But in general, Yannick comes in as the favorite. That has never been the case when these two have played. That can matter a lot, just in the mental game. I know it's weird. It shouldn't matter, but it tends to. At least sometimes. Sinner, as I mentioned.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night. And building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica. Empathy is our best policy.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun. And that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
From muddy jungle paths to snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder is ready to take you to some of the most phenomenal destinations on Earth. In a Pathfinder, it's more than just the arrival. The real excitement comes from the ride to get there. With 7 drive modes, Pathfinder's available intelligent 4-wheel drive is built for some of the most epic journeys. So chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures in the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. Intelligent 4-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
Awesome stuff. He crushed Jan Lennard Struff in a match that didn't take much longer than Alcaraz's win. It was 6-3, 6-4. Hour 14 minutes. Couple of things on this. First of all, Struff was serve and volleying. What makes serve and volley available? What opens up that tactic? Deep return position, as we have famously discussed with Daniil Medvedev, deep return position opens up that tactic because there's more time to close in on the net and there's more court to volley into, both width and depth. There's more court to volley into. The other thing that opens up the serve and volley is when you have chip or block returns. Because when you open up the racket face and chip, the ball doesn't stay as low. It is possible to hit a low chip return. Federer was, for example, exceptional at it. But it's a lot easier to make the ball dip when you're hitting topspin, obviously. So topspin returns, they're not just quicker. They don't just get on the volleyer quicker, but they also stay lower on average. So look, this is tough against Sinner. Sinner does neither. Sinner doesn't stand deep, and he hits over all of his returns humanly possible. Even returns that ordinarily would be so good, it would force mere mortals to take a hand off the racket and slice. Like, even really good serves, Sinner manages to drive on the return. I've highlighted this for a while now. It's a very Djokovic-like quality that Sinner has. So you're going to struggle to serve and volley against that. You just are. And the passing of Sinner also matters. The break point in the second set was a good example of this, where I thought Struff hit a nice first volley that stayed really low. The volley was, it was a stick volley. And Sinner had to go down and hit a backhand pass from his ankles. I'm so amazed by two-handers who hit this shot well, because I personally just can't even imagine myself hitting a two-hander from the ankles as well as some of these guys do it. But Yannick does a really good job of using his legs, getting low, and using his left wrist on the backhand to kind of, even though the ball is basically scraping the court surface, he can still get the path of that racket, you know, underneath the ball in kind of a high to low, swing path using the left wrist. And then the other thing is, again, just who is going to be the better baseliner here? And the problem that I've always talked about with somebody who is reliant on coming forward and serve and volleying in a particular matchup, and in some cases it wasn't even a particular matchup, it was just like with a player like Maxime Cressy, is you really can't serve and volley on a second serve reliably unless your opponent stands way deep. And you cannot serve and volley on return games, of course. So I like to point that out, because Sinner was too good off the ground against Struff's movement. Anything attackable and it was over. because Sinner was unbelievably precise when he had anything to hit. Like his attacking off the ground was super, super, super clinical in this match. Struff, he's not going to move well enough to be able to withstand that. I talk about big forehands. I talk about pace generation. Sinner averaged the same as Alcaraz on the forehand, 81 miles per hour. Thanks, Tennis Insights, for that. And also, Sinner's forehand quality in the first set was 9.9, easily the highest I've ever seen. I'm guessing, and maybe they'll do some sort of infographic on it, I'm guessing he didn't miss one, and he had a handful of winners, and he averaged, you know, 81 miles per hour. So, I mean, I've never seen a 9.9 on their shot quality scale. Sinner's draw has also opened up. Andrei Rublev was his seed. And Jiří Lehečka beat him in straight sets. I believe it was 6-4, 6-4. And I have more Tennis Insights stuff for you here. Lehečka hits as big as everyone. As big as anyone. And it's really a matter of, you know, are the errors piling up on Jiří Lehečka? Is he making first serves? Is he making returns in the court? Big picture, the learning curve with Lehečka, the development with Lehečka is putting balls in the court. But firepower-wise, he's through the roof. His forehand averaged faster than Alcaraz and Sinner's, 83 miles per hour. But that's not even notable compared to the backhand. The backhand numbers for Lehečka in this match were completely off the charts, through the roof, an anomaly of a number. He averaged 79 miles per hour on his backhand. That's good for a forehand. Jiří Lehečka's average, his average speed is 71 miles per hour, which is above the tour average speed, which is 67 miles per hour. This is absolutely wild stuff. To average 79 miles per hour on the backhand and to put enough balls in the court where it actually works and you win the match is something special. It really is. Unforced errors, I don't know what Tennis TV has. They usually score unforced errors a little bit better than Infosys. But Infosys has Lehečka winners 31-8. 31-8 winners to unforced errors. It has Rublev with almost as good a ratio, 8-4. So it has Rublev 8 winners to 4 unforced errors. Net points, Rublev 2-7. Lehečka 8-10. I got a little bit busy and I didn't see all that much of this match, but it's very clear what happened here. Rublev got hit off the court. He got hit right off the court. Lehečka hit triple the winners, averaged 83 on the forehand, 79 on the backhand. I mean, that's all you need to know. Seriously. A big picture thought, real quick. Craig O'Shaughnessy has this philosophy that the forehand is a sword, backhand is a shield. Of all of the things that Craig has done, I think number one, the number one best thing he's done is make rally length more of something that people pay attention to when it comes to tennis statistics. I disagree with some of his philosophies in regards to rally length, but I agree with his emphasis on it, and I think that's been a great service that he's had. But this, I would put number two with Craig O'Shaughnessy's influence is the sword shield philosophy, which I feel like is a fantastic, fantastic philosophy that a lot of people can understand, particularly the men's game, a lot better by thinking of the forehand as a sword and the backhand as a shield and looking at matches that way and seeing, well, how well does the forehand sword perform? How well does the backhand shield perform? I'm not saying it's no longer relevant, but I am saying it's becoming less and less true when I look at the young players coming up. more and more, I think we're seeing players who threaten in a big way with power, not just skill on the backhand, because we have long seen, you know, long line of really good backhands. Here's the point. Alcaraz, Runa, Sinner, Mensik, Fonseca, all of these guys have the very distinct trait of threatening offensively off their two-handers. You are not safe if you find their backhand on the return. You are not safe when you hit a second serve into their backhand. You will be hurt. And oftentimes in the past, especially 2000s, 2010s, it's let me hit a good enough backhand to find my forehand on the next ball. And that's the function of the backhand. But more and more, I'm seeing big ones. There are still young sword shield players. I would say Sebastian Baez is a sword shield. Arthur Fies, sword shield. Medvedevic, sword shield. Although he's not having a great year, is he? So I just wanted to say that. Let's end on this Coco Gauff tweet. So I'll pull it up here so you can see it on YouTube. It's on the bottom. The bottom is the original tweet. And here's what I said. I said, Gauff's WTA career win percentage is 69%. In three setters, it drops to 67%, minus two. That's the drop. Swiatek, 80% overall, 66% deciders, minus 14. Sabalenka, 68% overall, 54% deciders, minus 14. Rybakina, 69% overall, 54% deciders, minus 15. So then I said, Coco is the outlier. She is abnormally good at winning close matches. What spurred this on? It was Gauff won a third set tiebreak against Clara Burrell. And I was thinking, man, she always wins these. You know, a lot of players play her tight. A lot of players take her three, but it just feels like she always wins. So I did a deep dive and I saw, wow, her three set record, her win percentage is almost good as her overall win percentage. And then I thought, well, that is different. That is unique. So let's compare her to the other three best players. Swiatek, Sabalenka, Rybakina. And sure enough, 14 percentage difference. 14 percentage difference, 15 percentage difference. Gauff's is two. Now, miraculously, this made people lose their minds. And I don't believe it. I've had a philosophy on Twitter X recently where I want to be less controversial, less opinionated. I'll save that stuff for YouTube. And I'll just tweet, you know, a lot of stats, sometimes funny stuff, like sometimes just what I'm feeling in a given moment, like pictures, you know what I mean? Just less punditry on Twitter. So I'm just tweeting a stat here, and God, the way a lot of people reacted to it was like, I just delivered a hot take. The thought was that Coco is not an outlier, because she's only 1% better than Swiatek in three setters. That is true. It is also true that Iga, first of all, she's just been better than Coco in her career. She's had a better career than Coco. You can see that in overall win percentage. And she's just as good at winning three setters as Coco. But here's what nobody could get. Not nobody. Here's what many people couldn't get through their thick skulls. The fact that Iga is this much better than Coco, but not better in three setters, it tells you something. And I don't think it says anything about Iga. I think it, because Swiatek, that looks very normal to me. It tells you something about Coco. That Coco's endurance, nerve management, mid-match adjustments, play under pressure is exceptional. And as I said, also in this tweet, I said abnormally good, which is a phrase that people seem to struggle with for some reason. Is the word abnormal, it automatically has some like weird negative connotation? I mean, it's just the opposite of normal. Like, I didn't know that this word was so charged. Okay, so one more thing. Quality of opponent, right? You could say, well, Coco's going three against players who she should just beat in straights. Yeah, sure. I mean, that's also true. But it doesn't account for this entirely. And it's still, like, you can have that context in your head. You can interpret the data however you want. And it's completely reasonable to do so. To think, well, when Iga goes three sets, usually it's against players who are higher level than when Coco goes against three sets. That, I didn't do that level of deep dive, but I believe that would be true. It doesn't account for how different and how impressive and what an anomaly statistically this Goff number is. And it does say something about her game. Now, men's side, somebody said, can you do this for Big Three and Murray? So let's end on this. Djokovic, 84% overall win percentage, 72% in deciders. That is a 12% dip. Nadal, 83% overall, 68% deciders. That's a 15% dip. Federer, 82% overall, 65% deciders. That's a 17 percentage point dip. And then Murray, 74% overall, so significantly lower than the other three, 68% in deciders. That's a 6% dip. So Murray has by far the smallest dip, but he also has the lowest win percentage. So again, it is a little bit easier. That said, does it not tell you something about the way Andy Murray wins tennis matches? That despite his win percentage being far lower than Federer's, far lower than Nadal's, his deciding set win percentage is better than Federer's and the same as Nadal's. It tells you that similar to Coco, Andy won a lot of matches on his endurance, on his play under pressure. And by the way, they play kind of similarly. Fantastic movement, making tons of balls, grinding and defending at the highest level. Great backhands, forehands that leave just a little bit to be desired. Djokovic also comes across very impressive in this stat. To be 72% in deciding sets, that is 4% better than Nadal's career, 7% better than Federer for his career. Enjoy the rest of Indian Wells, everybody. I will talk to you after the final. Hope you enjoyed. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
Want to make mom's day? Get to your Nordstrom Rack now and score amazing deals for Mother's Day, which is Sunday, May 12th. Find tons of gifts from only $30 at Nordstrom Rack. Fragrance, jewelry, luxury bags, activewear, beauty, and more. Save on Kate Spade New York, Stuart Weitzman, and Ted Baker London. Great brands, great prices. So shop your Nordstrom Rack store today and treat mom to the good stuff from just $30.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night, and building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica, empathy is our best policy.
From muddy jungle paths to snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder is ready to take you to some of the most phenomenal destinations on Earth. In a Pathfinder, it's more than just the arrival. The real excitement comes from the ride to get there. With 7 drive modes, Pathfinder's available intelligent 4-wheel drive is built for some of the most epic journeys. So chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures in the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. Intelligent 4-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions.
When your space has the long-lasting, noticeable scent of Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist, you'll want to invite everyone over. From book club to reality TV watch parties, even the in-laws.
It smells. Amazing.
Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is infused with 2 times more essential oil versus regular Airwick Essential Mist for our most authentic, nature-inspired fragrance experience. Airwick Vibrant Essential Mist is perfectly portable and effortlessly easy. The way fragrance should be. Now that's a breath of fresh Airwick.
When it comes to teaching kids and teens about money, practice makes perfect. That's where Greenlight comes in. With a debit card and money app of their own, kids learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Parents send instant money transfers, create custom chores, and automate allowance, while kids track their spending, set savings goals, and practice money skills they can use today and for life. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.